The disparagement of Yiddish has been an element in the program of every group concerned with the modernization of Jewish life. The father of Jewish modernity, Moses Mendelssohn, described Yiddish as a jargon, and he encouraged all those who were concerned with the Enlightenment, all those who were eager for Jews to move from their narrow parochial world as he saw it into the larger world, were encouraged to do all that they could to erase the knowledge of Yiddish and to substitute for it fluency in German, French, or English. Indeed, one of the major accomplishments of his life, in Mendelssohn's own judgment, was his translation of the Bible into German. Not into the German as we might read it with the usual Germanic alphabet, but into a German which was essentially a transliterated Hebrew or Yiddish. Using the Hebrew alphabet, which is also, of course, the Yiddish alphabet, he wrote out the German text in the hope that he would, in that way, train up a generation of Jews who would become easily familiar with the language of high culture. And the great historian of the 19th century, Heinrich Goetz, the classic Jewish historian of the day, called Yiddish a despicable tongue and did all that he could to disparage and discount its use. And these are men of another century. But many of us grew up in homes where parents or grandparents spoke Yiddish, but only to each other, rarely in front of the children, as if they were convinced that Yiddish was the language of the past, English was the language of today and of the future. One of the interesting facts of Americanization, the Americanization process among Jews, is that we created in America literally hundreds and hundreds of religious schools and hundreds of Hebrew schools, but less than a handful of schools which were designed to train up another generation of young Jewish Americans in Yiddish. Now, there are many reasons, some of them contradictory, for this disparagement of Yiddish by the advocates of modernity. The 18th and 19th century was the great era of the emancipation. Jews were, for the first time, bedazzled with the possibility of citizenship. And in that age, nationality and language went hand in hand. English was the language of the Angles and of their descendants. French was the language of the Franks and their descendants. German was the language of the German peoples and of those who came behind. And Yiddish was the language of the Jid, of the Jew, the Jewish people. In many minds, Yiddish was equated with nationalism. And only by putting Yiddish behind could the Jew who was a member of the Jewish nation become a Jew who was a citizen of the German nation. And so the advocates of political emancipation insisted that Yiddish be forgotten, discarded. It was the language of a Jewish concept of nationality, which in their minds no longer had relevance or meaning, which stood in their way of the Jews' full acceptance into the larger world, into the new world. And paradoxically, though in the minds of many Yiddish was an assertion of Jewish nationality, those who were most determined to assert Jewish nationality, the Zionists also had their argument with Yiddish. To them, Yiddish was the language of galut, of the exile. It was a language which reflected in its vocabulary, in its patterns of speech, disparagement of all that was manly and virile and free in the Jewish spirit. I remember many years ago hearing a Zionist speaker remark on how many synonyms there were in Yiddish for an incompetent: a nebish, a nudnik, a shlemiel, a shlemazel, a luftmensch, and on and on and on. At the same time, he said, there's no word in Yiddish for a pioneer. And when the first chalutzim, the first pioneers, came to Palestine at the turn of the century, They came face to face there with the old yeshuv, a Yiddish-speaking yeshuv, old people mostly, crowded in the old city of Jerusalem, the sacred city of Safed, Yiddish-speaking peoples who spent their lives praying for the coming of the Messiah, steeped in a world which seemed superstitious to the young person who was going out to work in the swamps of the Chula with their hands. And in turn, these Yiddish-speaking members of the old yeshuv looked upon these newcomers as brash, as contemptuous of Jewish values, and as blasphemers, for essentially what they were doing was to force the hand of God, to force the coming of the Messiah. And so the Zionist movement had a great quarrel with Yiddish. And it was not unusual in the 1920s or 1930s for settlers, when they were walking through the streets of Haifa or Tel Aviv and they would hear some new arrival speaking Yiddish, to say to that new arrival, Goy, medaber ivrit. Essentially, you Yiddish-speaking person are not yet a part of the Jewish people. Be one of those of us who speaks Hebrew. There were other and subtler reasons for the disparagement of Yiddish. During the Middle Ages, high culture was defined in the Christian world as that which was written in Latin. The only literate class was the priestly class. Their texts were written in either Greek or Latin, primarily in Latin. All the teachings of the church were in Latin. Latin was a language of culture, and it was a language which was limited to the literate classes, to the male, to those who had achieved high culture. That which belonged to the women, that which belonged to the peasant, that world which was the world of the semi-literate or illiterate worker, was a matter of indifference to those who spoke of a high culture. And that's a similar division existed in Jewish life. The sages, the scholars, the rabbis, the disciples spoke Lashon HaKodesh, the holy tongue, Hebrew. All that was worthwhile was written in Hebrew or in Hebrew and Aramaic, the Bible, the Talmud, the Midrash, or materials from the philosophers which were translated quickly into Hebrew. Hebrew was a language of high culture. It was a culture which was achieved only by those who had been through the advanced training of the all-male schools. Anything that was worth writing was worth being written in Hebrew. And though Hebrew was not the language of the everyday, though it was not the language of the home, of the kitchen, of the street peddler, of the marketplace, Yiddish was generally that language. Hebrew was the language of the university, of the yeshiva, of culture. And yeshiva and Yiddish from almost the very beginning achieved this notoriety, if you will, as a second level language, subordinate to Hebrew. And that which was worthy was in Hebrew. That which was less than worthy was in Yiddish. And when in the 19th century Jews wanted to go back and find only that which was worthwhile in their tradition, when they wanted to put behind them the superstitions and the Kabbalistic nonsense and the writing of amulets and all that went with the piety of Europe during the Middle Ages, they dismissed this entire other world, the Yiddish world, as unworthy because the great texts were in Hebrew. And if you look at the seminaries and the advanced Jewish instruction in the 19th and 20th century, most of it was designed to acquaint the new student with the great pieces of Jewish literature, almost entirely defined as Hebrew or as Hebrew and Aramaic literature. The world of Yiddish was discarded as unworthy, as medieval, as ridden with superstition, as mamalashon, a mother tongue, a tongue adequate for children, adequate for women, adequate for the semi-literate. But now that we are manly and of a new world, let's put us behind us, let's reform our traditions, and let's find that which is truly classical. And all that is classical, supposedly, was in Hebrew. So Yiddish was, to a sense, abandoned by modernity. But if you have been keeping up with your histories, you know that sometime in the last generation or two, we moved beyond modernity. A strange idea. But you and I are no longer moderns. We're what is called postmoderns. We are people for whom the problems of emancipation, the first blush of the Enlightenment, are no longer the living issues. We've broken with medievalism, and now we have to find a new balance, a new set of institutions, a new group of core values, one fit for our particular perspective. And if the disparagement of Yiddish is one of the classic features of modernity, a reawakened interest or reappraisal of Yiddish is one of the critical factors of postmodernity. And the reasons are equally complex. In part, we now have a new definition of modernity. We have a new definition of nationalism. In America, where the bulk of the Jews now live, the centers of Jewish life in Eastern Europe having been effectively destroyed by the Holocaust, in the United States, it is now no longer an act of faith that to be a good American, you have to speak English, an interesting paradox, and only English, and nothing but English. We now have laws on the books which require that in our public schools, children who come from homes where Spanish or some Indian tongue or Chinese is the native tongue, the language of the home, that these children be given during their elementary school years instruction in their native language. Instead of the melting pot, we now talk of cultural pluralism. We now talk of the importance of ethnic studies. Generally, the society admits the value of a group of various disparate groups, each possessed of their own culture, and each giving from the best of their culture and the insights of their culture to the strengthening of the common weal. And so this idea that you had to give up with that which was uniquely yours, culturally, has been left behind. And Yiddish, to a certain degree, has benefited by this new concept of nationalism. And in Israel, of course, Hebrew won the day. The Jew in Israel feels himself one with biblical man, the free man, the man of independence, of spirit, and who controls his own destiny. Majority of the Jews in Israel today did not come from Yiddish-speaking backgrounds, and so Israel can tolerate again a Yiddish-speaking minority, which will bring to the fore the greatness and the values and the traditions and the literature which was coded in Yiddish and which to a certain degree had been left behind and jettisoned just a generation or two ago. And then, of course, something happened in the last century in Yiddish literature itself, which no one really expected. In 1850, Abraham Geiger, one of the leading scholars during the early years of the Reform movements, described Yiddish as a tasteless language and said categorically that nothing that was original of merit had ever been written in Yiddish. And in doing so, he was simply echoing and being a little more blatant about what many of the more traditional rabbis felt about Yiddish, that in fact only translations, only that which was essentially unworthy had ever been written in Yiddish. But then beginning in the 1880s, we discovered that there were a succession of men of literary quality, Shlomo Aleichem, Peretz, Sholomash, the Singer brothers, who wrote in Yiddish of the Eastern European Jewish experience, and who wrote novels of merit and of quality, so much so that they were recognized as such by critics who were at home both in the Jewish world and in the larger world. Suddenly there was, in everybody's mind, a Yiddish literature of quality. And one of the things which made people appreciate this new Yiddish literature is another feature which is peculiar to postmodernity. If the 19th century defined culture in terms of Harvard and Yale and Cambridge and Oxford and the Sorbonne and Heidelberg, the 20th century began to see the value of the proletarian in literature, of popular culture. The 20th century is the century in which there's been that revision of history which has rediscovered the hitherto unseen and the hitherto unheard. The worker, the peasant, oral culture, the unseen, illiterate peoples of Africa, of Asia, and of the Americas, whose literature was oral and passed on in that way. We've seen a new interest in primitive art and primitive music. But most of all, we've seen interest in those people whose voices have always been part of history, but never been heard really by those who define history by their writings. And so we've had women's history and labor history and folk history. And Yiddish was seen as the language of the Jewish folk, the language of the working class, the language of Jewish women, the language in which the great mythological literature of the Jews was encoded. And the richness of this folk tradition was fully appreciated now in the 20th century and came to be valued as we were valuing all the great folk traditions of the past. Whatever the reasons, then, in this postmodern world, it's no longer imperative that Jews who want to be part of the larger society not admit, that they know Yiddish. Last week, I went up after our services to Cambridge. Harvard University was dedicating a new center for Jewish studies. It was an interesting program. And one of the most fascinating features of the program was that the major scholarly lecture was given by a man from the Hebrew University named Hanna Shemiruk, and it was entitled The Place of Yiddish in Ashkenazic Jewish Culture. Yiddish never had such a grandiose academic title before. And more than that, here was a professor from the Hebrew University who was an expert in Yiddish and Yiddish literature, speaking of Yiddish and Yiddish literature by invitation at Harvard University, where I assure you a generation ago, any professor who spoke Yiddish did not list Yiddish as one of the languages which he controlled when he wrote out his curriculum vitae for the university. How the lowly have risen. Now, what have we discovered in this reassessment of Yiddish? We now know that when the Jews of the Mediterranean world moved into Europe 1,000 years ago, these small communities of Jews took over the language of the communities which they joined. The first movement was in Western Europe. The first language which Jews took over was the Romance language, which ultimately developed into French. This language that the Jews developed, that is, they spoke the dialect or the language of the country in which they were a part and added to it the words which were peculiar and special to the Jewish culture. This dialect, if you will, this dialect was called La'az, Lashon Amzar, the language of a strange people. It's a Talmudic abbreviation. And I suspect that the basic language of the Jews of Europe would have been a French-based language, not a German-based language, if in fact in the year 1290, under the pressure of the Crusades, the French kings had not summarily exiled all Jews from France, and so the development of a French-based Yiddish was aborted. But many of the words from this language moved over with the exiles into Germany and are part of Yiddish today. After a meal, a traditional Jew benches. And we think of benching as a kind of absolutely homey Jewish term. But benching is essentially a French term, a Romance language term. Benize, to bless. Benedictus comes from the same root. It's the blessing the Jew offers after the meal. And on the Sabbath, when the Jew would make a hot pot, a stew which would somehow stay hot over the Sabbath period, and he would call it cholent. Cholent is nothing more than the French chaleur, hot, chaud, turned into a noun, turned into the Sabbath meal. The exiles went westward to the Rhineland into southern Germany. And there they met a small Jewish community which had moved 200-300 years before north and had taken over the Middle High German of the period and added to it the Hebrew and Aramaic words, other words which were familiar to them. And it is on this base that Yiddish, as we now know it, grew up. Yiddish is essentially, in its origins, a Judeo-German dialect. It became more and more separate from German over the ages because the Jewish community was kept in apartheid, kept separate from the larger community. And so you have in Yiddish words which are essentially German in origin, gut Jahr, Jahrzeit. And you have words which are combinations of German and of Hebrew Aramaic. You know the word klutz kasha? A silly question? The word kasha is a Talmudic word which means a question. Middle High German klutz was a wooden beam, and a klutz became a stony-faced person, a person who didn't react. And somehow over the years, klutzkasha became the question asked by a fool, a stupid question, a question for which there is no answer. Now, Yiddish was very important to the Jews of Europe. It was important because it was the living language, it was a speech of the everyday. It was important because it being written in Hebrew, it allowed for communication in matters which were not holy between families, scattered between communities. So it was the language of communication and the language of commerce. And over the years, it became more and more a separate tongue from the Middle High German in which it began. It became the tongue which was spoken primarily by the non-cultured class, that is, by the non-intellectual elite, by the women, by the peasants, and by the workers. And because it was not the language in which you studied the Bible, and because no one bothered to translate Halevi or Maimonides into Yiddish, Yiddish culture was different than the High Hebrew culture. The High Hebrew culture, the culture of the sages and the rabbis, was Torah. The Low Hebrew culture, the culture of the everyday of most people, was an agglomeration of a whole lot of things, some of which were Torah and much of which was purely European. And one of the fascinating elements about Yiddish is that it was the means by which European culture, in all periods, was transmitted to the Jewish community, particularly to the women. And it's one of the reasons that throughout Jewish history in Europe, it is the women who have been most aware of what's happening in the larger world and most interested in what the larger world describes as culture. The men had Torah and Talmud, and in the Middle Ages, well, you know the first major work translated into Yiddish? No, it wasn't the Bible, and it wasn't a prayer book. It was the legends of King Arthur and of all the knights of the Round Table. The songs and the ballads of the minor singers and the troubadours, these were translated early on into Yiddish. And in the 19th century, to jump over periods, women still majored in Yiddish. This was their language. And very early in the 19th century, they began to translate Goethe and Dumas and Mary Shelley and all the novels which were emerging into Yiddish. And it was women within the Jewish community who really first understood what modern literary values, what culture was all about. And one of the great repetitive tragedies of Jewish life in Eastern Europe was the doting father who wanted his daughter to be educated but couldn't give her the classic education because that was reserved for men, who sent her to a Yiddish-speaking school or a Polish-speaking school where she learned about Western culture. And then he married her to the best catch available in the Jewish community. And who was the best young man available? The brightest student in the yeshiva. And the brightest student in the yeshiva had no knowledge of Western culture. In fact, had been trained to disparage Western culture. And here these two young people met under the marriage canopy. And it was an intermarriage. It was a marriage of people of two different sets of cultural values. And tremendous conflicts arose in Jewish homes, especially if you had an independent-minded woman, as to what were the true values in which the children should be raised. And I suspect that you can still see in the modern Jewish community this conflict of values. Torah has now been secularized to whatever a man's profession may be. That's his world, be it law or dentistry or the rabbinate. It's the women who do the cultural work. It's the women who are interested in the art museum, the women who are interested in the musical arts association, it's the women who are interested in literary clubs, and to a large degree, it's the women who even today remain those who bring the values of the literary cultural tradition of the larger world into the Jewish home. But be that as it may, in Yiddish during the early centuries, 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th centuries, most of the writing was either translations from the general literature or books of simple piety to edify the women. Once the rabbis discovered that women knew more about King Arthur than they did about King David, They quickly ordered the translation of the Mises of the Talmud, of the wonder stories about wonder-working rabbis, about the simple pietistic, moralistic stories, the legends of the Jewish people. And some of these books, like Senorena, were among the most popular of all of the books in Yiddish during the Middle Ages. And then about the 15th or 16th century, Yiddish moved to the east. It moved away from Germany toward the eastern lands, where for two or three centuries, the Jews provided almost the entire literate bureaucracy, the bourgeoisie, Poland, of Russia, of Hungary in the West. And here, Yiddish met a third European Jewish language called Lashon Kanaani, the language of the Canaanites. The Canaanites, you remember, were the people who inhabited Palestine before Moses and the tribes arrived there. They were enslaved during the period of the conquest, and Kanaani became a synonym in Hebrew for the slave. Well, the Jews were moving into the land of the Slavs, and the language which had been developed there before Yiddish moved in was called Kanaani. And this language had its own set of inflections, of grammatical rules, its own vocabulary, and there was a wedding between Judeo-German, Yiddish, and this language of the Canaanites, the Slavic Jewish tongue, and it's essentially out of that that the living Yiddish of today emerges. It's to to these people that we owe to words like parva, which meant in the Slavic tongue a vegetable, and came to be used in Hebrew as that kind of food which is neither milk nor meat and can be eaten with both. Some of you may have had in your homes a pushka, a little charity box, usually a little blue box for the Jewish National Fund. Well, pushka is another word, simply meant a box that comes out of this Hungarian, Slavic, Polish, Jewish background. Then its own set of expressions, new, came into Yiddish, only when Yiddish moved to the West. So did the end Nick, my pie Nick, you know, somebody who belongs to a particular group. I heard a conversation some time ago which tickled me. One person asked another, "Do you know any Yiddish?" And he said, "Of course I do. Well, give me a word in Yiddish." And so the word that was given was "no good Nick." Nick, Hungarian, no good English, no good Nick, perfect Yiddish. When the Yiddish moved to Eastern Europe, another thing occurred. Hasidism, the great pietistic revival of the 18th century. Hasidism was a revolution of the Jewish masses against the domination of this intellectual elite. It emphasized simple piety, the joy of everyday, rather than scholarship and learning. But it was also completely orthodox. But one of the ways in which it expressed this populist rebellion against the authority of the intellectual elite was to see to it that in all of its schools, Yiddish became the language of instruction rather than the Talmudic language, which is a combination of Hebrew and Aramaic. And it is only in the 18th century that Yiddish becomes the language of the yeshiva. It becomes the language of higher Jewish education. And now it has interpenetrated all of the avenues of Jewish expression. And it is only in the 18th and 19th century that you begin to get works on halacha, works on some of the major themes of Jewish life appearing in Yiddish. And by the beginning of the 19th century, Yiddish is a language spoken almost universally by the Jews of Europe. It is now no longer simply a street language. It's a language known by all Jews, and some Jews are beginning to break the taboo and to do things which are of the high culture, that is, of the Torah culture in Yiddish. Yiddish then has had a very ambivalent relationship with our Jewish community. It is mama lashon, it is the language of the everyday, the language of the home. At the same time, it's been a language of assimilation, of acculturation, the language by which the Arthurian romances and the romance of the 19th century come into the mainstream of the Jewish tradition. It's a language which to some defines Jewish nationalism, and a language which is opposed by Jewish nationalists as typical of the degradation of the exile. It was a language in the 20th century which was used consciously to assimilate Jews. The first modern Yiddish periodical, Hamavaser, which began to be published in 1862, began with an editorial statement which is essentially an apology. The editor said, "We apologize for using Yiddish as the language, the vehicle for communication in this magazine, but there's no other way to reach the Jewish masses, and we need to bring to them the message of modernity, of Russification. At the same time, within 20 years, a great movement emerges in Eastern Europe of cultural nationalism, the Bund, a workers' populist nationalism, which was opposed to Zionism but insisted on the identity of Jewish life, of the Jewish proletariat of Poland, Russia, and wanted, in fact, some kind of national, of land base for this identification within Europe. And the Bund deliberately cultivated the use of Yiddish because it was the means of expressing the folk culture, the laborer's culture. It was a means of attacking the religious culture because it had not been used over the centuries primarily as the vehicle for Torah, for religious instruction. So there's been this disparagement of Yiddish, and then there's been this reassessment of Yiddish, and then we come to the question, our final question, what are the future of Yiddish? Well, Yiddish has now won a Nobel Prize, and the lowly have risen. And there are some, I'm sure, who are tempted to believe there'll be a renaissance of Yiddish-speaking peoples, literature, as well as this reappraisal. I'm not confident of that. Isaac Bashevis Singer, who won the Nobel Prize, is an interesting illustration of the reasons that I have my doubts as the Yiddish will ever become, again, a major vehicle for Jewish expression. Isaac Bashevis Singer has published four major novels in Yiddish. For those four major novels, he earned less than $3,000 in royalties. If you examine the way in which Isaac Bashevis Singer writes, you find that he is a Yiddish writer writing for an English-speaking audience. And that's a fascinating change. Much of what he has written has never been published in Yiddish, but has been published in English. And what essentially Isaac Bashevis Singer does, and this is not unlike, by the way in which Sholem Ash worked to a certain degree before him, is he writes his novels in Yiddish. It's the language of his birth. It's the language in which he expresses himself. He didn't come to the United States until he was in his early 30s. And then he sits down with a so-called translator. He doesn't give the translator the manuscript. In fact, some of the translators know little or no Yiddish. But what Isaac Bashevis Singer does is to sit down with these men or women, and he expresses in the best English which he can master what he's trying to say. And then the translator, who's essentially a stylist, suggests to him how it could best be said. And then they argue about the translation, and they finally agree, and that's what is ultimately published. Isaac Bashevis Singer publishes a great deal in Yiddish. In Yiddish, in the Daily Forwards in New York and elsewhere. But most of what he produces in Yiddish, he produces under a pen name, not his own name. And he himself dismisses this as newspaper writing, ephemera, things written for the moment. He has clearly abandoned writing Yiddish novels for a Yiddish-speaking audience because there's simply not enough Yiddish-speaking readers available to allow him as a writer to earn his living. He's now a Yiddish-speaking writer writing for us, for a non-fluent in Yiddish, literate in English audience. And there's a big audience out there of us eager to read what he writes. All the great writers in Yiddish in the last century were born, nurtured, conditioned, raised in Eastern Europe. No major Yiddish writer of consequence has emerged outside of Europe, in Israel, in the United States, or Latin America. And none is likely to. Because no one is likely to make the effort to write in Yiddish for an audience which simply isn't there. And that intense, very rich folk world in which nurtured these men has disappeared, was destroyed by the Holocaust. And there's nothing which the experience of a Jew in Israel or New York or Cleveland, which is peculiar, which needs to be expressed in Yiddish and couldn't be expressed in English or in Hebrew or in some other tongue. So it's very unlikely that there will be a real renaissance of Yiddish literature. What is more likely, and what is in fact occurring, is that there will be a greater and greater appreciation of the contributions of Jewish literature, Yiddish literature, over the last 1,000 years. And that finally, and for the first time, we will be given the information which will allow us to assimilate into our understanding of the development of Judaism all of that literature which fed the hearts, the souls, the minds of the ordinary Jews of Europe for 1,000 years. And that itself will be a great contribution, is a great contribution. Oh, there are any number of writers, of poets in modern Yiddish, of newspaper writers. There are still two active newspapers in the United States, several in Israel, more than two in Latin America. But it's a diminishing, or rather stable, audience. And there has been no great demand for Yiddish studies in the American university or in our religious schools. It's still a language, it's a living language, a language of the past. And so if I were asked, you know, how fares Yiddish today, I would answer, belept. Belept is what? We're alive, but it's not we're alive with any exclamation point. It's glorious to be alive. It's a great day out there. There's a wonderful future ahead. It's, I'm alive. Thank God. Don't ask too much. Amen.